So to start off with, we will have the reading, of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And then we'll have the announcements. And then we'll have a talk. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissension or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. The work and the end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is a similarity of aim, purpose, and teachings, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, but belongs to each and all. Now here in Philadelphia, we do our part with spread broadcasting the teachings on Sundays and on Wednesdays. Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 8:30, we have the class in the Ocean of Theosophy by Mr. Judge. Also on Wednesdays, the library is open, which is a reference library in the front of the building, from 5:15 to 7:15. There's always someone there to help you to look up some reference, or you may browse through whatever you wish in there. Also, on Sundays, we have talks and discussions. Now, we're starting off with our next session of three, being April, May, and June. These are start at 11. They're over promptly at noon. And the doors open at 10:30, so you may come in and find yourself a seat. April is an interesting discussion. It's on psychism and spirituality. And, of course, today we will be doing the symbols and the meaning of Easter. There's also coming up in May, which we'll mention now, is a special meeting, White Lotus Day, dealing with HPB and theosophy. And that's on Wednesday, May 6th. We will be giving you reminders of it. So primarily, we are but one of 28 lodges that are situated throughout the world. And all doors, as we say, are open to anyone without any distinction at all. So this morning, with this idea, we will have a short Easter talk, and then we will have time for questions and answers and discussion.
Life laughs in bud and bloom from out the bough. 'Tis Easter now. The sun his golden journey makes and circle wide across the sky. O radiance, teach us how to mirror in our eyes the gleam, to let shine forth the light we dream. This Easter now. Today, April 5th, we celebrate Easter, a day full of tradition when we hunt for colored eggs, exchange colored eggs, and even in some parts of the world, give colored eggs as gifts. Isn't it always interesting to discover that many of the customs and the festivals that we observe in this day and age, without knowing the reason for their observance, have come down to us from races and civilizations long since dead. It gives us a strange feeling to find out that there is indeed nothing new under the sun, and that what we are doing today, other people in other lands did in other times. It makes us realize that if anything is of true importance to man, it must be universal in its expression, whether it be a custom or the celebration of a festival. In this sense, the celebration of Easter, with the ceremonies that go with it, is a universal festival, and consequently gains in its importance because of this fact. We wonder if we realize that we are actually taking part or participating in an ancient sacred festival centuries older than the modern Christian celebration, which, by the way, began in the 4th century, in the year 325, to be more exact. We wonder if they knew that this sacred festival is actually a physical event, a day set apart to do certain physical acts, such as feasting, or fasting, or giving alms, or listening to discourses, or reading sacred texts. A day fixed by the great teachers of the ancient world out of their profound knowledge of astronomy and its soul, astrology. If we look back into the night of time, we find that the hunting of eggs on a certain day in the spring of the year was customary in many countries long before Christian days, and that it symbolized the resurrection, the new birth, which took place in nature in the spring. We see the ancient Babylonians worshiping the egg which was hatched from the goddess Ishtar, in the same way that we find the ancient Egyptians paying homage to the egg which came from the mouth of the unmade and eternal deity, Kenneth. We find in Scandinavia the worship of the pagan goddess of the spring, Ostara. And we read tales of the old Norsemen exchanging colored eggs on this certain spring day in commemoration of this goddess. Even among the Hindus, we find the idea that the mundane egg in which Brahma was gestated broke its shell in the spring. So we see that the egg is an ancient symbol with a universal meaning. During Easter, Christendom observes two events: the crucifixion of Jesus and his resurrection. According to legend, he was crucified on a Friday, and he rose from the dead the following Sunday. Easter, therefore, must represent both death and life. The death of Jesus of Nazareth, his burial, the disappearance of his body, and the subsequent appearance in his physical body to his followers, ending with his ascension in body to heaven, has given the idea that at the last judgment, the dead will be revitalized, and the good or the believers will be taken to heaven to remain there forever. And the wicked and the non-believers will be condemned to eternal punishment in hell. If we look at this story of death and resurrection, we find that it is a gross caricature of very old and ancient initiation ceremonies practiced by Egyptians and other civilizations. In these ceremonies, which took place in caves, crypts, temples, pyramids, and elsewhere, the neophyte underwent a series of physical and physiological trials through which he proved his strength and readiness for spiritual rebirth. It was through these trials that strength can be gauged and full control attained by the inner immortal entity over the personality and over nature's forces. Apart from the idea of resurrection and the second birth, this spring festival shows us how death is always followed by life, as spring follows winter in never-ending succession. The seed sacrifices itself in order that the plant may grow. The plant life produces the flower, which has to die if the fruit is to follow. And within the fruit is the seed for perpetual immortality. Slowly but surely, the idea must take root in men's mind that death is an important stage which marks the destruction of form and the regeneration of spirit in a better form. The practical value for us in this idea is that it shows that there is in us an entity which can enter, leave, and re-enter the body, that in fact we are twofold beings, the outer body of the flesh, the inner is the Christ. All evolution is for the purpose of bringing to birth, in matter form, the Christ within. Therefore, it is possible for each of us to be resurrected. This body personality we prize and nurture is but the sepulcher which hides the glory of Christ. The door is closed by the stone of matter, which prevents the Christ spirit from manifesting itself, and the passions crucify the Christ. The scripture says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock," referring to the Christ being locked out of our heart. So Easter is about bringing forth or resurrecting the Christ within us. To do this, we need to work on cleansing the temple of the personality while remaining conscious all the time of the duality which is us. And last, from the poet Matthew Arnold, "The seeds of godlike power are in us still. Gods are we, bards, saints, heroes, if we just will." The talk for today, the symbology and meaning of Easter.
Now, we have time for questions, answers, hopefully, and discussion. Yes.
When Christ was taken off the cross and put into the tomb, he told Mary, when she attempted to touch him, he said, "Touch me not, for I have not crossed over yet," within that 3-day period. My question is, after the 3 days, what happened to the body?
Oh boy. What happened to the body?
Yeah, once he crossed over, 3 days were over, what happened to the body?
Okay. Okay, wait, hold on, because I come from a different background.
We've been studying that in our ocean class, is that when we die, we are to let the body rest or alone for a certain period of time. And that gives it a chance to recapitulate the entire life. And that that once that is done, the body is vacated. And the body breaks down as we know it, but it goes back into its constituent parts of nature as this eternal pilgrim goes on. You go on to Devakan, then on to Kamaloka, then Devakan, and then when all that's exhausted, he's drawn back into life again. So,
if this is what you were speaking of, then the thing of it is, you have to remember, as the story goes, he would have been someone who knew more knowledge than the rest of them. So it could be also symbolic, but this is the theosophical idea of what we know about what happens when the physical body no longer exists. It goes through stages, and then, as I said, it dissipates back to nature.
If I could just clarify my question. My question is in reference to the body of Christ specifically. The tomb was found to be vacant, empty. So obviously the body didn't just lay there decomposing into all the elementals that it needs to. Is there any theosophical writing specifying what happened to the actual physical body?
No,
this is an allegory of initiation. Theosophy is telling us, get away from the carnalized Christ. Don't even look at it. It's a myth. This is initiation here. This isn't vicarious atonement or anything, and the body is the least of our concerns.
But he showed up again, right, for 40 days. So what part showed up?
Again, we're talking about the story of the so-called Jesus and what happened. Historically, we have no record of that to fall back on. But the fact of the matter is, I guess, if we look at the idea of what the church, Christianity, has made of this individual, a lot of the whole backing of the church, down to what the priests wear, the ceremonies, are all bits and pieces that have been picked up from ancient, quote, pagans to make up these whole systems that they go through. So the thing of it being the matter is, if you're going to read it as it is and see it in that condition, we don't know what individuals would get from it, but from a theosophical or ancient Eastern religions and philosophies, it's more of the explanation of what's actually happening and the fact that we are spiritual beings using this physical body to work through. It's the idea of spirit and matter. They're really off one thing, but for spirit to give any life to matter, that is the fire. But the matter is what we will have to work through, and it is the physical body. So we really don't have much of a saying when it comes to this actual Christian idea of what Easter means. Yes?
Even the idea of Christ, as was said, is an allegory. But in our studies, we see that adepts are able to take their astral body and be in other places at the same time, and that the real body is not this physical, but it's the astral body. That's where all our senses are, all our organs. This is how we really communicate with all these lower kingdoms. So adept as Jesus was said to have been, would be just one of his bodies that
right.
that someone saw, and it's not a miracle. There's documented cases of it happening many, many times.
And we have to remember, we live in a universe of law. Nothing just happens. There are no mistakes. There are no miracles. There are no accidents, really. It goes back to you from going out in at night and looking at the stars and looking and understanding, for instance, the planets. There is no chaos out there. It all has to do with cause and effect and the recycling of cycles, only mostly in a spiral way. So there's constantly moving. So in that extent, if we look at it that way, life is an eternal way of living. It's action. And we see it all around it, from the universe down to here, our physical land, and the seasons, the night, the day, the seasons within our physical bodies that they go through. So there is no such thing, in a way, as miracle. If someone has the knowledge to understand what caused something to be affected, that's knowledge. That has something to do with this whole idea of the initiation that was brought up. And we have certain things here that we have that are recorded and were recorded by the Egyptians, for instance, how the neophyte went through an initiation. So in its many different symbols, and a lot of symbols basically go back to the ancient philosophies and the ancient teachings. Yes.
I think it was end of December we celebrated, or
winter solstice.
We made note of it mentally that it was the winter solstice, and we resolved to do certain things within our own nature, and we planted seeds then. And as those seeds were planted, they began to rise. They began to rise, and they blossomed forth in spring, in our nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's said that from the winter solstice to the vernal equinox is the most psychic time on this globe, and that the pagans always celebrated this time of year, because it was rebirth. It was about reincarnation. It was about their eternal spirit. It was about all those
right.
things.
And we see in nature that resurrection of it, in that the energy and the force is so strong between the winter solstice and the spring equinox, is we can take advantage of that energy that's all around us, that we breathe in and breathe out, and some of that medical and mental energy can be worked on and pushed on and give us like an extra shove if we would be aware of it and listen to it, that inner true nature that wants to also be resurrected.
So the question still is an interesting and pertinent one. Like, just in the history of the Christian church, we find it interesting that, okay, so the tradition of the Savior dying on the cross is in the church, but really it's not until the 5th century that it is depicted graphically and specifically in the art of the Catholic Church, not so much in the Eastern churches, in the Orthodox, but in the Catholic. And what was going on for a long time was this argument between the Gnostics and the church. The Gnostics saying, well, the apostles saw Jesus in his, what they called a docetic body, or basically the astral body. And the church would be insistent, no, he physically rose from the dead. And that's why so often in a Catholic church, I mean, you see this painting and the blood and sweat, and it's horrible, to drive home that his physical body, this is what it was. But before all of that, so that argument was going on for centuries, but before all of that, still the tradition is there that he died on a cross.
Right.
So what's interesting is the Savior dying on the cross, that tradition also is for Buddha and for Krishna and others. So therefore, there's a universal application of it. So what is it about us or within us that needs to die on the cross in order for us to take the next step in our evolution?
Very good question. What is in us that needs to die off? And we could say, let's talk about the duality within us. We have a personality, and we have our individuality. Now this, we have a sevenfold nature, we have three that are eternal, and we have four that are transient. They're part of that matter that we spoke of earlier that is used by that which is in us that's eternal. So if we look at the idea that the personality that we have in any one life has been made up many lives, maybe, of being the same type of atmosphere. We say, look at our character. If you look at a person's individual type character, this is something that we have created. And it wasn't created in just this one lifetime because it doesn't make any sense. When we see that we have certain traits that we have that nobody else in the family has, so we can't go back to, well, it's our family, it's humanity in general. No, it's our making. So if what has happened, that after incarnating so many lifetimes and being able to work on this, quote, personality, this costume that we've made, it's very difficult to work through and try to get it under control by that part of our nature that we all have, at one time or another, have heard or felt or known, that part that knows this is not the right way or this is the way to go. That feeling that you just know it's innate in you. Take the idea of justice. There's a part in our nature. We know what's just. Little children know what's right or wrong. That feeling, that's not fair or this is fair. That part of our nature has been so many thousands of times clothed in personalities that we usually have picked up from sensations that are outside of ourselves. Some of the things that we say we like or we are really not us. They're somebody else's. We've just sort of sponged and taken in and said, that's us. But if we look to the part of our nature that always seems to be there, and if we work on to listen, we can hear that true nature, that nature that we really should connect with and be able to give more control to this personality, this chariot and the charioteer, and the chariot and the horse. So which are we? Are we the charioteer in the chariot commanding the horse to go, or are we just sort of let the horse take us on? Yes.
Around this time of the year, I hear a lot of statements out in the public saying that Christ died and spilled his blood for us, or on our behalf. Now, theosophy teaches that there is no such thing as vicarious atonement. Now, Christ, being the master that he was, knowing the laws of nature that he did, is it possible that he could somehow uptake or absolve some of the karma of the people around him at that time, and as a result died in the process? Does theosophy say anything about that?
If we look at the idea, again, there is nothing historical written down about this at all. We do know that crucifixion was a way of punishment in the Roman times. So, if in fact we do acknowledge whoever this individual was, had to be at a stage of adeptship, had to have more knowledge than the rest of us do. In due course, they do have the power to help eliminate or alleviate situations for others. But what we're trying to say is, if you're going to read the Bible and read the stories that you're hearing word for word and look for answers there, you're not going to find them. It's there, the whole story, if you think of the whole idea of the birth of Christ. This was earlier celebrated sometime in April or May. It was the church that picked the date of make it December 25th because there was a festival, a large festival, going on at that time, and they thought that those people that were take part in that festival will not look to see what's happening with this small little group that we could work on and have our celebration of Jesus Christ being born. So even that story doesn't make sense, but there is historically things about the date that was picked. And if you look at the idea of Easter, and we talk about the spring equinox, that's more of a celebration around March 21st, the beginning of spring. So again, a lot of those ancient things are universal, and they've never changed wherever you are, whatever country you're in, whether it's Europe, whether it's South America, they all seem to, where they could not have had communication at that time, that there are certain festivals that are all around this whole globe. So a lot of this bit of questioning questions about the Christ is very difficult because there just isn't that much foundation. And since the church picks these dates for reasons, and the followers used to come, and a lot of them couldn't read or write, they believed what they were told. If not, they could have been put to death. Yes.
If we look back at the history of the church, mm-hmm. They tried to destroy all the symbols and,
right.
and markers and glyphs and whatever was denoted this pagan ideas. Now, but it's rather ironic. If you look at the Catholic Church, all this symbolism is very ancient. And it has a very universal approach. And as far as vicarious atonement, well, I think it was looked at as this Christos, this divine emanation, it dies for our sins. It symbolically is trapped, and it comes back again and again and again for our sins. It's not outside.
Right.
Everything that we interpret has to be inside, and if it then it begins to make sense.
In that extent, too, the only thing that we could think of after. When one starts doing theosophy, they start to have to also look into the Eastern philosophies. Where is the comparison? Where is there not comparison? To understand it's a broader scope and an older scope. So the only crux of this is the church making this whole idea of the Christ. And what Jesus did and what Jesus didn't do is they tried to say it was unique. It is not unique because if you read the history of many great sages and adepts that were mentioned, the Buddha, the Krishna, they all have the same story, born from a virgin mother. this whole basic idea to start reading back on all these different individuals, there is really nothing unique in the Christianity that isn't already been out and been, shall we say, not religiously, but in a way, yes, religiously, a devotion to these ancient festivals, because there were those who walked the earth also who had the knowledge, who knew, because they had lived through them in earlier lifetimes, and they know the whole meaning of cycles, that what goes around comes around. That's a natural thing. And they could know ahead of time what was going to happen. So if it wasn't for the idea, the uniqueness that they tried to put on it, one wonders what would it be. And we look around and we don't know that much about it. We're not from that background. But the fact of the matter is, if these things happened prior to this, and you can almost match it to match it, then those, quote, pagan ideas weren't pagan. They were very universal. Yes.
Well, what Theosophy tells us to concentrate on really is to stop crucifying the Christ within us.
Yeah.
Because we are crucified. Most of us, most of our lives, are really in the process of crucifying the Christ within us on the cross of matter. And what we need to do is, by lives of purity and sacrifice and altruism, is to stop that and raise the thief, and we're the thieves, up to paradise.
So you could take a lot of that symbology and break it down. Again, because it's universal, it's not unique. Yes, in the back.
Well, it seems there's nothing new under the sun.
That's true.
And what came to our mind was 1776 with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And then 100 years later, or rather 99 years later, 1875, when HPV... and her companions started the Sisonical movement. 1876, all you have to do is go over here in Fairmount Park. It's our understanding that HPB herself was here.
In Philadelphia.
So the few things that she gave us initially were those three fundamental propositions and the purpose and the aim, which would then carry us back thousands and thousands of years so that we could come forward and interpret all of these stories that the people have. And we'll find that authorities, quote, the church, etc., etc., and so forth, even today, having a very tough time maintaining the changes they made. So could you tell us, what was it that HPV...
Tell us
brought,
what?
What was it that HPV brought to us? And we honor for that, I think, on White Lotus Day, a few simple ideas that each one of us can independently research without argumentation as to what this means or that means, and we get a pretty good idea.
Well, the three basic fundamental principles are very important. If we look at the idea that this universe that we live in, we can take these ideas and actually test them and check them for ourselves. This idea of a deific principle, not a being, but a deific principle. If we look at the idea of consciousness, we're aware that there is self-consciousness and there is consciousness. We can see consciousness in the lower kingdoms. We can see it in the mineral, in the vegetable, in the animal. It's automatic. In the human being, as we are thinking principles, we have that in our higher nature, as was stated earlier, those three higher principles within us, that basic ray coming from that deific principle, which we all are, and the fact that there is a part of our nature that has accumulated all knowledge we have gained that is still within us, if we but knew how to touch it and tap it and tap into it. And usually we do every night when we go to sleep and go through the dreaming state onto the non-dreaming state. And that the fact, as we said, it's a universe of law. Everything works under laws. There are causes, you're going to get an effect, no matter how it is. And that whole system can work in every type of that we can possibly think of to check out the fact, if you make the cause, you're going to get the effect. And then we come to that third idea that brings in a lot of this idea of universal brotherhood, that we're all from the same, we're all from the one, we're just different expressions of that one essence, that deific essence. And due to that is our causes and our effects. So if you look at the idea of a deity, a universe of law, and for the whole purpose of evolution, is we're at, shall we say, the king point or the keynote of the progress of intelligence moving up in the lower kingdoms. We bring in those lower kingdoms day and night, breathing, eating. We're constantly moving life, units of intelligence. We are self-conscious. We can have the power and the use of that power of choice. The lower kingdoms work under natural impulse, but it is our job to help them, the intelligence within those different kingdoms, to start to move up the ladder too. And then in the grand sense, so that gives us a deific principle, it gives us a universe that works under law, and then finally it gives us the whole purpose is the evolution of all consciousness. Way in the back.
Yeah, what is, on a more mundane level, is there any kind of a meaning to the rabbit?
Is there any kind of meaning? Well, appropriation. We do know they just every year come around. Lots of little bunnies show up. It's that recapitulation, I guess you could call it. Other than the idea that they're very bountiful. And I think originally it was the hare.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
The hare.
Who brings in the... And we know about the coloring of eggs in all countries and the symbols of that. The symbol of the cross leads us back to the idea of initiation, too, as was brought out, and also the physical initiation that were held in Egypt. That were held in tombs, that the initiate was put on a pallet that was shaped like a cross. And the symbol of that is that lasted 3 days. Then on the end of the third day, the sun would come through a hole in the pyramid and shine down on the initiate's head. And that would be the awakening. So light has something to do with this too. The bringing, the bearers of light, the bringing of knowledge. So there's a lot of these symbols. If you trace them back far enough, they're very fascinating. Yes?
The egg.
The egg.
You know, it's a symbol for everything. It's a symbol for the universe. It's a symbol for the egg in the woman's body that is fertilized by a seed.
Right.
And I mean, the egg is such a symbol that we can find it in many, many, many kinds of expressions. But going back to HPV, these ideas are not hers. They're
right.
The accumulated wisdom of the ages. So that if you study philosophy and science, you'll see other beings who have taught these same ideas or have worked with nature and humanity using these ideas. So our question is, you know, one of the things that we are asked to do is to study other religions, but also to study that aspect of our nature that we don't pay attention to, that astral or that psychic nature. Why do we need to study this for? Is there anything that will, what will it do for us?
Well, what depth can we pick up for that? One, the idea of studying other philosophies and other religions is to see the universality that's within their teachings. And if you go back far enough in history, and for some of those that are able to go beyond recorded history, the nature of things and the way it works, that these certain ideas that are symbolically kept on, that they've never changed. And yet, no matter where you are on this globe, you can say a certain symbol, they all know what you're talking about. It's universal, and again, it's never changed. So one has to wonder, if something has never changed, it's always the same no matter where we are, what language we speak, then that should say something for that is constantly changing, which we know change is part of evolution. But these certain basic ideas have been there since the very beginning of time to be recorded, have been carried on and still exist today. This could be something that should help us understand when we get to ourselves. Like, who am I and what am I and why am I? If we start questioning about those, we could start questioning about our everyday life. Is there something here that's worthwhile, that's saving? Is there something that's never changed in a way we do a certain thing, and yet there are constant changes coming and goings around us? To give us some hints that I am more than just this physical body that I can look at a mirror and see. And what part of our nature, those astrals that we talk about, when the real man within us, the real spiritual man is in us, we are told that this is the part of our nature that can, in deep sleep, beyond the dream world, we communicate with all beings, all natures. And yet, when we come through the process of going from deep sleep through the dream states back to the waking states, we have to go out the same way we came in. And as we get closer to the end of the dreams and towards the working state, all that information and all that razzle-dazzle of the personal life starts picking up. So we might take a very spiritual, highly dream by the time it works back into our waking state, unless we have something to base it on. If anything really astounding has happened, we have no nature of it at all because we've lost it on coming back in. But there are those who, through practice, through meditation, have been able to bring back some of the experience that they have on, with their higher nature. And a lot of that is brought back through the astral. Those are our real seeing, hearing, tasting. Because it, even in a dream, we can hear something, we can see something, we can taste something. Well, this physical body is asleep on a bed. What's doing the tasting, hearing that music, seeing that sight? Who, what's working? They say that the real within us is what's doing it, that real astral that this whole physical body is made up on, it's the framework on. So this can give us a depth, a side of us that we've never really realized about ourselves. Yes?
It says that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. And we see a question was asked earlier about sacrifice. What does sacrifice have to do with anything? What does it have to do with nature? What does it have to do with us?
Well, let's look at what does it have to do with us. If we are true spiritual beings, in a way, we've sacrificed to come into this physical form, to learn to experience. That's what life is for, to learn and experience. And how hopefully gain from that experience. And with the word of sacrifice comes the word of devotion. To have the tenacity to, if I'm going to do this, stick with it, try it, test it as best I can in my everyday life. So the main sacrifice, and don't we sacrifice everything around us from the lower kingdoms every day when we take a meal? And could we not be thinking, am I affecting the lives that I've taken in that will be going back out into the atmosphere? Yes, we in turn do affect the lower kingdoms as we go through our daily duties and things. Yes?
One of the saddest feelings we have today is the memory of our very young days when Sunday was a big day for the children because Mother would read the comic strips and she would use a sort of stage attitude in describing Mandrake the Magician, Tarzan of the Apes, Buck Rogers, to name a few. The comic strips today are not, or then were not really funny, but today we have can find no evidence of those teachings, those ideas in our newspapers today. We assure you that coming into these rooms takes our mind back to those days when we as children were stunned and amazed and very much worshipped those characters that were very popular in, quote, funny papers, ideas in the form of.
Maybe what we need today are heroes. Do we have any heroes today? We have to think hard and fast. Those were the greats, the heroes, that were the do-gooders that went out and helped everyone in any situation. You don't have those, I guess, today in most of your comics. Yes?
Well, if we read The Passion of Christ in the light of theosophy, a young child could see a hero in Jesus, and we talked about sacrifice, who lived a life of service to those around him and who made the ultimate sacrifice, having suffered the way the story says that he suffered, and the effect of that was that he rose above his suffering and was available to others in spite of what he went through. And in certain ways, if we read that in the light of theosophy, that's the story of the Bodhisattva.
Yes, and again, we're going back to the Eastern teachings of the whole line of great Buddhas that have come down through the ages and spread the teachings. And we think of the greats, the Confucius, the Tao. A lot of the Patanjali's is another one. Patanjali's, which we do have now and use, is an excellent book if it fits your personality enough that you understand these are like rules to live by. But for others, they just might say, I just can't, it's just too confusing. And yet for others, it can be rules to live by, but it's very direct. We need something to give us that push to want to know, because it has to come to the time when you want to know that anything outside you that you have put in has not given you the answers you need. You need to first have to have that desire and then have that devotion to follow that desire wherever it may be. But to want to know, to be able to test, it says, check and verify it for ourselves, not something I've read or not something I've seen or something I've heard. I know, we can say that. I know now what this means. Yes?
You think perhaps that the push to want to know is somewhat dulled among the kids today, and it's because they're not idiots. But their grandparents are. And the problem is that when this idea of Easter is taught to kids, they have a hammer held above their head that's going to come down if you don't actually believe that he lived 2,000 years ago. Whereas if it were taught in the light of theosophy, in terms of an allegory, meaning that really there's something that you can see with inside of yourself and inside of everybody, and that there's a truth in here rather than this is the truth,
right,
then these kids are not going to try to accept some kind of absurd history. They'll be more off into a philosophic pursuit to try to find out what is the truth in the story of the Passion, rather than is the story of the Passion the historical truth. That is what is the distraction.
And we think, this is very funny, we want to use this as a clothing. As a closing, because it's very, very much of today, and it's coming from the Eternal Verities, which is a children's book, and it's on the Easter lesson, but it's very timely. But it's something we can think about when we walk away. So we can see that there is much more in Easter than flowers in the church, fashion parades, egg hunts, and candy rabbits. These things are only trifling symbols for truths men have always known. Whether in India, Scandinavia, Egypt, Greece, or even Mexico, when we think the same ideas, whether our skins be colored black or yellow or red or brown or white, we feel we are all brothers, souls of the one light and life. Meeting's adjourned.